This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker in Woods Hole. It's Friday, September 17th. This is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Eve Zukoff, Daniel Ackerman, and Jeanette Barnes. We'll check in with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner. We'll hear from Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times, and CAI's Catherine Ident and Mike Dean will be talking about all the news from the State House. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. The Barnstable County Board of Commissioners says it's prepared to take legal action over the proposed machine gun range on Joint Base Cape Cod. CAI's Eve Zukoff has been following the story and joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi there, Steve.
Eve, this project has been fraught for the Guard since it first really became public about a year ago. Now the county commissioners have raised these legal objections. Tell us what they're saying about the Guard's plan and why they're opposed to it.
Yeah, that's all right. So, okay, commissioners and their lawyers claimed that the Guard failed to comply with legal and permitting requirements during its decade-long pursuit of the range. And yet again, for those following this story, those alleged failures all center around the environmental impacts of the project. So the commission says the Guard's environmental reviews have been insufficient and that the eight-lane range could destroy valuable wildlife habitat and threaten drinking water because it would be built over the aquifer that serves Upper Cape Town's their drinking water. And the land on this base, the commissioner argues, is public conservation land where, you know, a machine gun range is just not compatible with water and habitat protection. Then on top of the environmental concerns, the commission and their lawyers say that the Guard hasn't gotten all their permits. They need a consistency certificate from the Massachusetts Office of Coastal Zone Management, and the project requires but hasn't received a two-thirds roll call vote of the state legislature. And one more layer on top of that, the commission says, frankly, the Guard's reputation around the environment makes it hard to trust that they will be responsible with a machine gun range project. The federal government has spent $1.2 billion already cleaning up past contamination of drinking water, and the commission doesn't want to risk more problems.
So the commissioners here sent their concerns and a warning that they're prepared to take legal action to the Environmental Management Commission. This is a state body. It has the power to deny this project. What happens next?
Well, what's happening here that's interesting is that the Barnstable County commissioners are putting the pressure on the EMC, the Environmental Management Commission, to reject the project. That's who they'd sue. The state, not the Guard. Meanwhile, I'll say a Guard spokesperson emailed us saying that they are reviewing what the commission said and do not comment on potential litigation. So now the EMC, you know, they were expected to hold a public meeting as soon as this summer about the range, where they would, you know, likely issue some kind of decision about whether they'd reject or push forward this project. But we don't know when they're planning to get together and take a vote on this project. This is my interpretation, but what I see here is that what this lawsuit is really doing is putting more pressure on the EMC so that if they approve the range, this could become an issue to Governor Charlie Baker, especially, you know, if there's litigation by the county and it comes in the middle of perhaps a re-election campaign for the governor, should he choose to take that on. He will have to ask himself, do I want to be in the middle of an environmental lawsuit on Cape Cod as I try to convince voters to pick me next November? Or do I want to tell the Guard to shelve this project?
Because ultimately, the governor may be the person with the say in this.
Yeah, absolutely. We've seen in the 90s, former Governor Cellucci, he shelved a project that was very similar to this machine gun range project. There is precedent here. There's absolutely a question of whether it is the governor's job at the end of the day to decide where this project goes.
Hmm. The first offshore wind project from Vineyard Wind moved forward this week. CAI's Daniel Ackerman reported on this. He is also with us now. Hi, Daniel.
Morning, Steve.
Daniel, Vineyard Wind has secured financing for this project. It's a pretty big number. Tell us how much they have in hand and what happens now.
Yeah, so the developer Vineyard Wind announced this week that they raised $2.3 billion, that's billion with a B, to finance the project. So that money comes from 9 different banks that have chosen to invest. It's a mix of US and foreign banks. And you know what happens now with that funding? The money is basically a green light for some of Vineyard Wind's contractors to begin construction. So offshore wind, of course, has been decades in the making in Massachusetts. The Cape Wind project didn't make it. The Vineyard Wind 1 project so far is moving forward. And as of this week, there are shovels in the ground, so to speak. You know, all the major offshore work, actually putting turbines and electrical cables in the ocean, that won't start until next year. But right now and throughout the fall, crews are going to start onshore work in Barnstable. They'll be doing things like preparing an electrical substation where the offshore power will eventually plug into the state's electricity grid.
There have recently been a number of lawsuits against Vineyard Wind, maybe 3 by my count. Do those impact any of this progress?
So these lawsuits come from groups concerned with how the wind farm could impact the commercial fishing industry or how it could impact endangered right whales. And it's not clear yet exactly where those lawsuits are going, but Vineyard Wind CEO Lars Peterson, he was asked about this at a press conference this week. And his response was, hey, we don't comment on, you know, active or pending litigation. But Peterson did emphasize that 9 different banks have thoroughly reviewed the risks involved here and still decided to invest billions of dollars in the project. So the developer and the financiers are clearly still moving forward with the project, and we will keep a close eye on how it all plays out in the courts. Hmm.
Eve Zuckoff, another story with high stakes that you have covered this week in an effort to eliminate toxic PFAS chemicals from firefighters' protective gear. This effort failed. It was rejected by a Quincy-based association that sets fire safety standards. There's a direct Cape connection to this, too. First, walk us through what happened with the decision.
Yeah, so firefighters and anti-PFAS groups asked the National Fire Protection Association's Standards Council to stop requiring a layer in firefighting gear to pass this test that essentially demands textiles containing PFAS chemicals. Basically, the middle layer needs to withstand 40 hours of continuous UV light. But in recent years, we've learned that high exposure to PFAS can cause testicular cancer, ovarian cancer, thyroid issues, all kinds of health problems. And studies have shown that firefighters have a higher level of PFAS in their blood than the general public. So representatives for this association based in Quincy had the chance to remove that test, that UV light standard, so that manufacturers could start actually developing PFAS-free firefighting gear. But in the end, the association voted behind closed doors, so we don't really know what happened, and wrote a letter saying they didn't want to remove the test before understanding how it could affect firefighter safety, and that the issue of PFAS in turnout gear would be taken up later by a task force.
And what kinds of reactions have you heard about this? Specifically, there's a group on Nantucket that's been very active here.
Yes, I've heard anger, I've heard disappointment, some heartbreak here, really. I mean, this is an emotional issue. I've locally on Nantucket, as you say, the Nantucket PFAS Action Group had already secured funding to buy PFAS-free gear. 4 Nantucket firefighters had the vote passed. And I mean, they were angling maybe to be among the first firefighters in the country to get fully PFAS free gear. This group, I mean, they were inspired after a captain on the force was diagnosed with testicular cancer with no family history at age 38. And they later found out about 15 to 20 current and former firefighters on the island have been diagnosed with cancers and illnesses associated with high PFAS exposure. So, you know, in reporting this, I spoke with the deputy fire chief, Sean Mitchell, and he said to me, you know, as firefighters, we know, we get it, that there are occupational hazards and we can't control a lot of that. We do breathe in smoke that isn't good for our health, obviously, but we'd like to have control over what we're exposing ourselves to in our gear. And it just didn't matter, apparently, enough to this frequency-based association that thousands of firefighters, including an association that represents 325,000 firefighters in North America, said, please get PFAS out of our gear. But, you know, this vote, Chief Mitchell and other activists have said to me, has just delayed the inevitable because they are going to keep going forward on this. It's too important. They say they're not giving up.
Daniel Ackerman, you also reported this week about a scrap metal operation at Brayton Point in Somerset. It's a story you've been following for some time now. The Baker administration recently sent a letter to town officials there about that operation. Tell us, what did the letter say?
So this letter, yeah, it was sent by the State Secretary for Energy and Environmental Affairs, Kathleen Theoharides, and it basically acknowledges the complaints of local residents. For more than a year now, residents around the Brayton Point area in Somerset have been complaining that this scrap metal operation is generating excessive noise and that metal dust is blowing off of the scrap metal pile and into the local neighborhood. And in July, the town select board in Somerset sent a letter to Governor Baker asking him to please address the situation. And they also pointed to property records that indicate the scrap metal operation is actually taking place on state-owned land. Now, the Baker administration had not previously acknowledged that Massachusetts owns that land, but in this response letter from Secretary Theoharides, she does make that acknowledgement. And she also indicates that she plans to work with the town of Somerset and with the state attorney general to take potential enforcement actions against Brayton Point LLC, which is the company that oversees the scrap operation there on state-owned land.
Now many people in Somerset are quite concerned about the amount of noise and metal dust coming off this scrap metal operation there. What does this letter seem to signal to them about the future of what could be happening there?
Well, it means that the state, which has previously been keeping this issue kind of at arm's length, might be taking a more active role in it. You know, last month, the state did fine Brayton Point LLC for water quality violations, but those were unrelated to the dust and the noise complaints by local residents. And now I think the letter could signal the state is looking into further action here. So it remains to be seen exactly what that will look like. But the state attorney general is investigating potential violations of the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act. So the state could sue the scrap metal operator on those grounds. Then there's also the question of whether Brayton Point LLC even has the correct state permits to be managing a scrap metal operation. Because that particular use of the land is not explicitly mentioned in Brayton Point LLC's lease with the state of Massachusetts. So we'll see how the state decides to proceed here, but it does seem like the Baker administration is taking a little more of an active role in the goings-on in Somerset.
Eve Zuckoff, let's talk about one more lawsuit you've been following. It's the latest development in North Atlantic right whales. So late last week, three environmental law firms said the National Fisheries Service doesn't go far enough in its latest efforts to protect North Atlantic right whales. What's their argument?
Yeah, one more lawsuit for you today. Okay, so the Center for Biological Diversity, Conservation Law Foundation, and Defenders of Wildlife, they have updated this lawsuit that they first filed in 2018, saying that the federal agency's latest rule, which puts new limits on the lobster and crab fisheries, just fails to prevent the critically endangered whales from getting tangled up and killed in fishing gear. But, you know, the rule they're referring to, it will do a number of things. It will reduce the number of buoy lines that run from lobstermen's traps on the surface of the water to the sea floor. It adds two new seasonal fishing closures, including one south of Martha's Vineyard in Nantucket, and weakens the remaining lines so entangled whales can more easily break free. But the conservation groups say these new measures will still allow the lobster fishery to kill right whales at an annual rate that's four times the legally allotted limit. And the species with a population that's down to 360 won't be able to recover, the conservationists say. And so these new measures, they call them, they're just fiddling around at the margins when it comes to actual protection.
That is CAI's Eve Zuckoff and Daniel Ackerman joining us. Thank you to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll be speaking with CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. We've gotten to this far into the show without yet mentioning the pandemic somehow. We will now remedy that, so to speak. CAI's Jeanette Barnes joins us with some updates. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve. It's good to be here, as always.
Jeanette, an FDA advisory committee is discussing booster shots for COVID-19 today. There's some debate over whether these boosters are necessary, but you talked to a local health official who says they're ready if and when the boosters come. Tell us, what did you learn?
Yes. Well, I talked yesterday with Deirdre Arvidsson. She is the public health nurse for Barnstable County. And she says they will be able to open a large-scale vaccination site for booster shots if it's necessary. She says they could do it at Cape Cod Community College, for example, you know, not unlike they've done in the past. But she's not sure they're really going to need it because COVID-19 vaccines are now available at more places like pharmacies and some doctor's offices. So people are likely to seek out the booster at those locations. And whether the county opens its own clinic will really depend on demand, she said. One more thing that's really worth mentioning here about vaccines, though, is that people who have compromised immune systems are eligible to get a third shot right now through the Barnstable County Health Department. That's technically not the same as the booster being evaluated by the FDA, and it's for people who meet CDC criteria for compromised immunity. So, like, typically that's people who are having active cancer treatment or who have had an organ transplant or something along those lines.
Following along some of this, you also reported this week on Barnstable removing the concrete barriers that have been on Main Street in Hyannis. They narrowed the street to create more space for pedestrians and outdoor dining during the pandemic. But this might not be the end of this sort of outdoor-focused atmosphere for Main Street, right?
Right. Well, this is kind of another sign of change in this pandemic, although the removal of the barriers is really more about, I think, the end of high season and less about any, you know, like reduced need for social distancing. But they did take them out. They are taking them out. Without that extra sidewalk space, the outdoor dining, the expanded outdoor dining that people have gotten used to is going away for now, because businesses can only do whatever they were permitted to do prior to the pandemic. A lot of people are looking to keep the best of what those barriers accomplished there on Main Street without the drawbacks. So normally traffic runs in two lanes in the same direction along Main Street in that area, and vehicles move pretty fast. So when they narrow the street to one lane to make room for the dining and retail stuff outside, some people say it made that whole part of Main Street a lot more shopper friendly or family friendly, you know, for walking. But that sort of artificial bumping out of the pedestrian area was only on one side of the street, on the north side. And some businesses on the south side said it was unfair. And other businesses said having a single lane of traffic caused more tie-ups or blocked deliveries, things like that. So there definitely was, you know, everyone was not of one mind about the barriers and the bumped out sidewalk. Elizabeth Werfbane, who is the executive director of the Hyannis Main Street Business Improvement District, she tells me the town of Barnstable is putting out a request for proposals to study ways to make that area more inviting year round. And that's, I think, based in part on lessons from the pandemic and that whole period. So if you're a fan of the extra dining there on Main Street, that may be a process to follow closely.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes joining us. Thank you, Jeanette.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
A significant land purchase on Martha's Vineyard will put a large parcel into conservation. Noah Asmo of the Vineyard Gazette joins us with this story and more. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Steve.
Noah, tell us about this piece at Redgate Farm that's been purchased. This is actually going to be part of a larger area that's going to be conserved.
Yeah. So for those who don't know, Redgate Farm is the former estate of Carolyn Kennedy and Edwin Schlossberg, and it was actually originally bought by Jacqueline Onassis, and she used it as a sort of private retreat in Aquinnah. It's a beautiful, ecologically rare parcel of land, pretty much between the Atlantic Ocean and Moship Trail on Martha's Vineyard Way in the up island town of Aquinnah. Earlier last year, the land bank purchased a huge portion of the property. I believe it was close to 304 acres. And now they just bought another 32 acres for $10 million. So the entire purchase in total is $37 million. And the original $27 million, this will be added to the original $27 million purchase in what the land bank is going to call Squibnocket Pond Reservation.
So in total, the how many acres are now being preserved here?
This is now 336 acres, which is it's a remarkably large amount of land. The Massachusetts Natural Heritage and Endangered Species Program, they've described the property as one of the most important tracts of land in the Commonwealth. There's windswept face Atlantic dunes, wetlands. There's about 1,000 feet of frontage on Squibnocket Pond in the purchase that was just made. There's also an old hunting camp that was part of it. It's not totally clear what the land bank's plans for the property are right now, but they plan to have it open next year at some time to the public. There is beachfront access as well on the south Atlantic-facing part of the island, which is exciting. You know, it's not totally known right now exactly how the access is going to be done, but it sounds like there's going to be some sort of parking lot, potentially some sort of reservation system, which the land bank has done, especially in recent years with the pandemic.
Any sense of what the time frame is here going forward for that?
Well, yes. The land bank is saying that they want it to be open to the public next year, so 2022. You know, that's of course up in the air, and I think depends on a large amount of regulatory permits that have to get approved. You know, this is a huge land purchase. It's a huge property, you know, for them to sort of set up what's needed for it to be open to the public takes a lot of work. But it's a very exciting purchase, and it puts, you know, more than 300 acres of land into conservation.
One of the great things about the Vineyard Gazette website is it has these links to older articles about the current articles. And along the side of this story, there's a link to a 1978 story in which Jackie Onassis breaks her longstanding silence to confirm that she is the owner of this 375-acre tract of oceanfront land in Gayhead. It's you just see kind of the history playing out over so many of the stories here. I just want to point that out because it's great to look at.
Yes, and check it out on the Gazette's website.
Definitely. Hey, I want to ask you about another story, a fun story about an island fisherman who really, without much exaggeration here, landed the catch of a lifetime. He did something that is pretty much unheard of. Tell us about this.
Yes, so Devin Metters, he works on a Menemshire charter boat, but he was fishing for albies on State Beach in Oak Bluffs. earlier this week in false albacore, one of the fish that are being fished in the Martha's Vineyard striped bass and bluefish derby. But he and a bunch of friends were sort of looking out and they saw a fin and they thought it was a brown shark. But then when they went closer and actually checked it out, they realized that it was a bluefin tuna swimming in waters that were about 2 feet deep and right on shore, which, you know, is extremely rare. Most of the time, bluefin tuna are caught miles offshore, and so he just sort of took the opportunity and ran into the water and thrashed around and grabbed the fish and was able to pull it out. You know, he described it as wrestling a jackhammer or grabbing onto a jackhammer, which I thought was funny.
So he got a bluefin tuna with his bare hands. He grabbed it around the tail and kind of hauled it up onto the shore.
Right, which I think in that instance is pretty much the only way you can do it. But I guess, you know, talking to him, actually, it is illegal to target bluefin tuna from shore. But I guess he called NOAA Fisheries. They said, you know, no big deal. We think it's a cool story. very fun. You know, the circumstances in this one seem sort of unique. And he thought that the fish hit was struggling a little bit. There was some, probably a health issue of some variety. Not sure what. It seemed otherwise healthy, but potentially injured. And I guess there was a bluefin derby off Nantucket a week ago. And so he thought, oh, maybe it was, you know, caught and some, you know, the release, maybe something happened and it was finding its way to shore and might have just been dying anyway.
It's a great story. Nice picture of him, too, holding that tuna there and
a
huge
awesome
grin on his face. That's Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, thanks a lot.
Okay, thank you.
A second town drinking water well in Chatham has been shut down. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us to explain what's going on. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
No surprise here, unfortunately. This has to do with high levels of PFAS being found. It's kind of a continuation of an ongoing story here and a difficult one for the town.
Sure. You know, earlier in the season, one well in off of Training Field Road here in town was shut down because of high PFAS levels. And they got some higher levels in a second well right adjacent to this well a couple weeks ago, and they did some extra testing, and that came back late last week showing that the levels had gone above the state maximum. And so as a consequence, they shut down that second well. You know, even though the summer season is kind of winding down, officials are worried that the absence of these two wells will put more pressure on the town's remaining wells. So earlier this week, the select board met and voted to ban all outdoor watering as a consequence. And they're urging homeowners with irrigation systems to turn them off, not just to, you know, don't wash your car or don't wash down the sidewalk, but turn off your irrigation system, try to save water and keep the other wells in town from overworking and potentially breaking down. These two wells off of Training Field Road are, you know, close together. And as we've spoken in the past, the town doesn't have any idea at this point of where this so-called forever chemical PFAS is coming from, but they're hiring a consultant to conduct a study to try to identify the source of that contaminant.
And now the town meeting in October will be taking up the issue of water infrastructure. This seems like this is going to be front and center here.
Yeah, this whole experience has prompted town officials to do really a critical assessment of the town's drinking water system and its capacity. So earlier at that meeting earlier this week, selectmen voted to call that special town meeting for October 23rd, and it'll focus solely on water infrastructure. There'll just be a couple articles on this warrant, they'll be seeking a total of $5.25 million for water system upgrades. $4.5 million of that will go towards finishing two wells near Mill Pond in South Chatham, as well as an associated chemical feed building. Now, these two wells were actually put in the 1990s, but there were problems with the water. Some contaminants were found, which has since dissipated, and the water has gotten a clean bill of health. And when these two wells are completed, probably sometime in the fall, if the money is appropriated, each will be capable of pumping around 1 million gallons per day. So that'll do a lot to relieve the pressure on the water system. And the other major article seeks $750,000 in engineering funds to develop a treatment facility capable of removing the PFAS chemicals in order to treat the water in those other two wells. That's the first step in towards that. The actual cost of the treatment facility will definitely come later. And that could be a couple of years down the line. So that's why it's imperative, officials say, to get these other two wells online. And both these expenditures are going to be paid through water revenue, so it's not going to have an impact on the tax rate. And selectmen are urging residents to back these articles to ensure that there's a continuation of a safe and ample drinking water supply here.
And that town meeting will be October 23rd, yes?
Correct. At Veterans Field, it will be held outdoors, you know, weather permitting, obviously. But selectmen are hoping that we don't get a repeat of some of the rains we've seen lately on on that date.
Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
The rise in coyote-human interactions on the Outer Cape has been significant. Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner has a look at these and what might be behind them. Hi, Marianne.
Hey, Steve.
Marianne, you and reporter Michaela Chesson talked with a number of people for this story. What are some of the factors at work here when it comes to coyotes menacing or even attacking people and their pets?
Well, there's actually quite a variety, and it really goes back to really the development of kind of human development in terms of coyotes, you know, normally living in the woods and grasslands. Then over time, there's been development, you know, particularly on the Cape, in terms of their increasing interaction with humans, particularly, you know, during the daytime. There are also other factors, such as if coyotes are starting to feed their young. And there can also be some disease, but that seems kind of rare. The two kind of more recent things have to do with people with the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, where people might be going to restaurants or staying downtown, they're spending so much more time, you know, out in the woods, walking, where there are more interactions. And also kind of specifically to Herring Cove Beach in Provincetown, is there's a real kind of maybe deliberate, but possibly not deliberate kind of opportunity for the coyotes to start to get a sense that they'll be fed with human food, even particularly Herring Cove Beach, which is big for picnics and beach fires and, you know, lots of human activity there. It's really, you know, it comes down to coyotes having the opportunity to and kind of getting used to being able to eat human food.
Mm. Just a kind of a shocking incident earlier this year, with a three-year-old getting bitten at Herring Cove Beach by a coyote. Tell us a little bit about that and what the fallout has been.
Well, you know, the experts that we talked to, that's definitely really rare in Massachusetts. But basically, it was a three-year-old, her family, she's from London, her family's from London, but they have a lot of family ties in Provincetown. And this was on August 11th, at about dusk or so. Her family was there at Herring Cove, and her mom, Megan Lewis, you know, says that they're not really neophytes. They know about wildlife. They know not to have food around and everything else. But they were had a blanket laid out. They're getting ready to do stargazing, and Elodie. She was a few feet away, and then the coyote came right out of the seagrass behind her and bit her twice, actually. He bit her once, you know, like face, ear, and neck, and then the coyote stepped back and then bit again. And then, of course, the parents, you know, grabbed her and ran up to the car, and then she ended up going to the hospital. And luckily, as what her mom said is that, you know, there was really great ER help at the Cape Cod Hospital, and also a plastic surgeon who has his stitching, I think, has since really helped heal the scars. I spoke to her, Mrs. Lewis, last week, and, you know, she said that Elodie is starting to, you know, she still mentions it, but, you know, there's quite a bit of recovery, you know, kind of physically and also just kind of mentally and emotionally is going on with the family. The other thing I wanted to mention is they started a GoFundMe page for fundraising for the medical bill, which is around $35,000, due to some complexities with the travel insurance that they bought.
And the coyote that was responsible for that attack was hunted down and killed, and they checked it for rabies and found that it was negative. Yes, so,
right. It wasn't rabid. The thing that was I personally understood better after, you know, working on this story is that a coyote that is going to jump out and, you know, bite a human, that coyote is probably abnormally habituated to human food. So it's not like every coyote at Herring Cove is starting to eat human food and they're all going to become kind of aggressive. But depending on the specific coyote, that one would be considered abnormally aggressive.
It's Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner. Marianne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. The battle over an erosion control project on Nantucket is continuing. A new independent report suggests that the erosion control measures, these large geotubes, should stay in place until a plan of coastal retreat can be put in place. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror has this story and joins us now. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, we've been following this story for some time. The Conservation Commission wants these geotubes removed. What does the new report say?
Right. Well, you summed it up pretty succinctly right there, is that this report from the town's coastal resilience consultant, Arcadis, which is a coastal engineering firm, is recommending that those geotubes, geotextile tubing that are at the base of the Sankaty Bluff and have sand poured on top of them in an attempt to stop the ocean from eating away at the bottom of the bluff, remain in place at least until a plan is fully in place to relocate Baxter Road, which is at the top of the bluff. It's the road that accesses the primarily summer homes at the top of the bluff and the Sankaty Head Lighthouse as well. But complicating matters, obviously, is the fact that the CONCOM has ordered the project removed, as well as the fact that a DEP-approved expansion is also tied up in Superior Court. Arcadis has warned, however, that if the geotubes at the base of the bluff are removed, either by a storm or by enforcement action by a group like the CONCOM, other interim measures could be installed to protect the bluff and the houses and road above it, but would not provide the same level of protection as currently exists from the geotubes. Those geotubes have largely stemmed the tide of erosion along the 900 feet of beach on which they are installed for more than 3 years now. But the CONCOM did order them removed since the Sconset Beach Preservation Fund, which installed them and got approval to install them, has failed to keep them covered with the exact amount of sacrificial sand required in its permit. The SBPF is expected to appeal the removal order in Superior Court. It hasn't done so yet. It hasn't actually officially received the removal order as of yesterday afternoon. The Select Board has also been trying to convince the CONCOM to reverse its decision and work with the SBPF and the town to find some kind of a compromise that takes its concerns into consideration, but also considers the larger picture of erosion in the whole area. The bottom line of the report, however, is that eventually Baxter Road will have to be moved one way or the other, and the timing of that move could be as soon as 10 years. And that would require taking of easements on private property, moving utility lines, water and sewer, and probably some eminent domain property takings as well. And that's a price tag right now that's already at $24.5 million. And the longer the town waits, probably going up every year, every day.
Let me ask you about another story you guys have this week. It happened, actually came out yesterday, kind of a surprise move. The island's health board voted yesterday to keep an indoor mask mandate in place. Tell us what's going on.
They did, and a number of indications leading into yesterday's meeting was that that mask order would be lifted or at least relaxed. The town's health director, Roberto Santamaria, told the select board on Wednesday night that he was leaning in that direction. He had indicated earlier in the month and in the time between when it was enacted and continued back in August that depending on what the case numbers looked like, that would probably be his recommendation. But when the board met yesterday afternoon, he didn't make that recommendation. He recommended that it stay in place at least. For the time being, the board agreed with him and is not going to necessarily take it up again until their next monthly meeting, which is in the middle of October. And that does that decision does come despite Nantucket's caseload dropping significantly in recent weeks. Nantucket is the only community in the state right now that is not on the CDC's high risk or red zone list for the prevalence of COVID. But Santa Maria did say that even though that was the case, being in the significant category is still enough to reason to keep the mask order in place. In the last 2 weeks, only one patient has been hospitalized on island because of COVID-19, and the town's weekly COVID report, which covers last week at this point, it's released every Friday, reported an average of just over two cases a day for a total of 15 all of last week.
That is Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, where you can find all these stories. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
On Martha's Vineyard, high school seniors have a new requirement, and it's getting a fair amount of notice in the community. George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times has this story and more and joins us now. Hi, George.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
George, high school seniors are all now required to take a course in civics. Tell us what this means and what's behind the move.
Yeah, so this is going to be a course where all the seniors get together, by the way, in the Performing Arts Center. So this requirement is for the entire senior class, and they're going to get together for these lecture sessions, and it will involve, you know, bringing in some members of the community. In fact, you know, some of your neighbors in Woods Hole coming over to talk about climate change, for example. But they'll also be touching on things like government and politics, human rights, civil rights, globalization, global economies, all those hot button topics that get people riled up on Facebook and Twitter.
And on your website in the comments section, actually.
Absolutely. So lots of people in our comments were right on, you know, kids ought to be have a civics course in high school. And then there were people who were concerned, well, exactly what are they going to be teaching them? Because as we all know, there are climate deniers out there. And, you know, some of those came to bear in the comments saying they're concerned about what might be taught in this particular course to these seniors. The idea is to get them engaged and talking about current events and issues. And, you know, as a newspaper, dealing in current events, we're all for it.
To have an educated public is so important, and it seems like a good step forward, one would think.
Yeah, many people make that point in the comments that, you know, these particular individuals, some of them may already be eligible to vote as a senior in high school. They're 17 and 18 years old, so they ought to know what's going on.
Hey, let me ask you about another story, a nice story you had in the paper. With the anniversary of 9/11 on Saturday, you spoke with the priest of Grace Episcopal Church in Vineyard Haven about his connection to the tragedy. It's a tremendously moving story. Tell us a little bit about what he told you.
Yeah, Rich Salzberg did this interview with Reverend Stephen Harding, and he was a chaplain at a hospital in New York City at the time of the terrorist attacks, and immediately went to one of the hospitals into the emergency room so he could be there to greet those who were wounded, injured in the attacks. And, you know, he stayed on and eventually became a chaplain at Ground Zero. And as you said, his comments are incredibly moving. His recollection of what happened there are incredibly moving. And he went back. You know, it was the 20th anniversary, as we all know. And so he went back and attended a ceremony for the fire department's 18th Battalion, where he said it was incredibly emotional, which, you know, wasn't a surprise to him. But what was a surprise was the level of openness that he felt there. And, like you said, just a moving interview and definitely worth your time reading.
Definitely. And one of the things he mentions that we don't hear a lot about is we hear a lot about that morning and what happened that day, but really the aftermath that went on for months. And he was there as part of the, I don't know if they called it the recovery or just taking apart the scene there and recovering many, many bodies and what happened as each was brought to light. It was very moving story that he has, and as we say, it's in the Martha's Vineyard Times. Rich Salzberg did the story. Salzberg, thanks a lot, George Brennan, for joining us this morning with that.
Thank you, Steve. Take care.
State lawmakers have been back to work now for more than a week, and they are slowly putting their agenda together for the fall. CAI's Catherine Ident talked to State House reporter Mike Dean about this and why we might want to keep an eye on the Boston mayoral race down here on the Cape Coast and Islands. Here's their conversation.
Morning, Mike.
Good morning, Catherine.
Not to look at another recess since state lawmakers just got back from their summer break, but I think it's important to note because they only have until Thanksgiving to get some work done before they're off again. So what are the priorities that are shaping up?
It really depends on who you ask, you know, because the legislature is two branches, the House and the Senate. Some of the priorities are a little different, and some of the variations of the same priority might be different. So they definitely have a lot of bargaining and going back and forth to do if they are going to get anything done. But both branches do agree that putting a spending plan in place for at least some of that $5 billion in federal funding that was part of the American Rescue Plan Act is the top thing to do. Karen Spilka, the Senate president, she told me last week she wants to spend some of that money on intergenerational care. That's kind of a state-sponsored care for children and for seniors to help families, to help working women kind of get into the workforce. She sees that as an economic development tool and just kind of that kind of people-based infrastructure that's become a topic in government the last year or so. This process, though, when you take a step back, it's actually pretty fast-paced, even though it's been taking months and months to get something out the door. That pace can really be attributed, at least partially, to Governor Charlie Baker, who's been hammering the need to spend much of this money as soon as possible. And it could be that because Democrats are kind of responding to him, that Baker may have had more of an influence on their pace than he usually does.
I want to turn now to the National Guard, because some of Massachusetts National Guard have been training this week to fill in on school bus routes due to a severe staff shortage that affected a variety of communities outside of Boston.
Yeah, so the governor, Baker, he called up 90 Guard members to train to drive these 10-passenger vans. And they're going to be dispatched to cities Chelsea, Lawrence, Lowell, and Lynn. Those cities asked the state for help because this bus driver shortage has caused so many delays and missed pickups, not just in those cities, but all over Massachusetts. Some of that has to do with just the shortage of bus drivers after this pandemic, different mandates on their time, if they want to go back to that kind of work, if they feel safe in that kind of setting. Obviously, children are amongst the largest unvaccinated population now. Baker's order would allow up to 250 Guard members be activated to help out communities if they request this service. Baker's going to use federal money that can be reimbursed. That's one of the reasons for using the National Guard. And really, the governor explained this, kind of characterized it as one of the growing pains that school districts are going through as they reopen after this pandemic.
And finally, it was a big week in Boston as the mayoral race went from 5 candidates down to 2. We did talk a little bit about this last week. We're paying attention to this race down here on the Cape Coast and Islands in large part because it's historic.
Exactly. And one big historic part already happened in this preliminary election, like you said, that left us with Michelle Wu and Anissa Asabi George as the two candidates. All three of the Black candidates did not make it through that preliminary election, including the acting mayor, Kim Janey. But Wu and Asabi George are both women of color, so we will have our first female mayor and our first mayor of color. So that's the historic part that we're looking at right now. And as I've said a bunch before, as goes Boston, so does Massachusetts. So you're definitely going to feel that impact of, Boston's plans of development, Boston's tax base, Boston schools, people moving in and out of Boston around eastern Massachusetts, all those things trickle down. So even on the Cape, you will feel the impact of what could be a historic new administration in Boston City Hall.
And that is CAI State House reporter Mike Dean talking with us, as he does most weeks, from Boston. Mike, thanks a lot. Have a great weekend.
Great to be with you.
And that is CAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean there. That's our show for today. I want to thank my guests. We heard from CAI's Eve Zuckoff, Daniel Ackerman, and Jeanette Barnes. We spoke with Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Mary Ann Bragg at the Provincetown Banner. We heard from Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, and George Brennan of the Martha's Vineyard Times. And, of course, CAI's Catherine Iden and Mike Dean talking about the news from the State House there. Big thanks to Dan Treidle for engineering the program. In radio, engineering is kind of a euphemism. In this case, it means doing just about everything, and nobody does it better. Thanks, Dan. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thanks for listening.